What's on NATO's mind?
Georgia. Georgia.
That's right. NATO leaders, without Ray Charles, get together for the first time since Russia moved troops into Georgia, and there's a lot to talk about. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates defends the decision to expand NATO.
Just an old sweet song.
An old sweet Cold War song. World peace or provoking Putin? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, September 18th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, America's financial worries have ricocheted to Asia. Markets there have plunged. We'll take a look at the global problems. Also, the train collision in Los Angeles last week has triggered a whole lot of questions about U.S. rail safety. NATO meets today. Afghanistan and Russia top on the agenda. And a new way to judge colleges, this time with inside information from students. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
Central banks from across the globe are joining forces today. The Federal Reserve is chipping in with banks from Europe to Asia to throw as much as $180 billion at the tanking markets. That's just the U.S. contribution. News of the extra cash has European markets up slightly. Wall Street futures seem positive. Wall Street is hoping to get in on some of the optimism. Cautious upward movement comes on the heels of another disastrous day for U.S. markets. That was despite the $85 billion bailout of foundering AIG. So far this week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down a nail-biting 7%, its lowest point in 3 years.
In Galveston, Texas, city officials are now taking back the offer to let residents stop by their homes to pick up supplies. Yesterday, a huge traffic jam choked the one road onto the island as thousands of people tried to head home. Here's city manager Steve LeBlanc.
We just had an overwhelming influx of people. And we decided we just simply cannot handle the volumes of people that are coming in.
Seven American soldiers were killed in a helicopter crash in Iraq today. The Chinook transport helicopter was trying to land at a base near Basra when it went down, probably due to mechanical problems, say officials. They also say hostile fire did not cause the crash.
Drivers in Minnesota honked their horns and waved American flags as they crossed the newly opened I-35W bridge this morning. State troopers officially opened the bridge in a solemn ceremony just a few hours ago. The old bridge collapsed a little more than a year ago, killing 13 people. Tzipi Livni, Israel's foreign minister, could be the country's next prime minister. She just barely won the ruling party's vote to replace outgoing leader Ehud Olmert. If the coalition holds, she could be Israel's first female leader in more than 30 years. Oil prices fell in Asia, but they're up against about $100 a barrel in trading in Europe. The Dow lost more than 4% yesterday. The S&P down almost 5%. Set to open positively, the S&P at 1156. A rocky week on Wall Street, but what about your street? We're also talking about colleges. Did you wish you knew more about your college before you went? What was the selling point about where you went to college?
Andrea from the University of Vermont. I absolutely loved college, and I knew nothing about where I was going. It was the only place I decided to go, and I think that where you go, it's as though you have to create where you go. Every place is different.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's been a very tense week on Wall Street, and today a very tense day in Asian market trading. Tokyo's largest exchange fell by more than 3% in the morning session, and there were similar falls in Hong Kong and South Korea. We're joined now by Juliana Liu, a BBC business correspondent based in Singapore. Welcome, Juliana.
Thank you.
And clearly there's a lack of confidence in the way that the U.S. is handling the banking crisis here. What are they saying in Asia?
Absolutely. There is lack of confidence. And in fact, I've been watching the Asian markets even before they opened this morning. And when they opened, they initially tracked Wall Street. You know, Wall Street was down at levels we haven't seen for about 3 years. And that's where Asia started the day. Early on in the day, the MSCI index of Asian markets outside of Japan was down 5%. And if you look at where they are on the year, it's more in the high double digits. So tremendous selling in banking shares, tremendous selling in property. In Australia, for example, Macquarie Bank was down 23% earlier this morning. And these are the kinds of losses that we saw for most of the early trading day. In fact, the markets that closed relatively early here in Asia, Japan, Korea, and Australia all closed between 2 and 3% lower. But then we had the central banks in US and EU and Japan saying that they would pump all that money into the money markets. And that's finally when we started to see a turnaround. But this turnaround, you know, who knows how long it could last? It could just fizzle by tomorrow. There's a tremendous lack of confidence in the financial system. What we have now is a situation where banks are sitting on their money. Even banks that do have money are unwilling to lend to other banks, to consumers, to other businesses. Cash is really king right now. So the real fear is that the credit crunch that we've been seeing for the last year and a half will get much worse, and that it will spread to the real economy in terms of people lending to each other and not expanding their businesses.
And so what are, you said that money has been pumped into some of the markets. Can you give us some specifics as to how officials in various countries have been responding?
Right. Well, I think, you know, they're all trying to do this in a coordinated way so that they're all acting together to try to restore confidence in financial markets. And again, we don't know, you know, in the long term how much confidence there is. But right now it's the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, and also the Central Bank in Switzerland saying that they will give $180 billion and putting that into the into money markets so that if banks want to lend money, they can. They don't have to hoard it. So that's what they have said that they've done. The markets seem to like it. But long term, will the markets continue to be confident about the central bank's ability to keep doing this? We're not sure.
Well, Giuliana, you mentioned cash is king. I guess that's really the big indicator here. Is there any sign whatsoever that aside from sitting on cash, that this money is finding any sort of safe haven in any kind of investment, even commodities?
Yes, gold jumped yesterday in the States, and today in Australia, at least, we're seeing a lot of the mining stocks jump because, you know, obviously they're mining gold, copper, aluminium, different metals out of the ground. And so we are seeing some safe haven outlets for people. But, you know, for people, cash is really what they want. People are hoarding onto their cash. It makes them feel safe. But this is, you know, not good for the global economy. It's not good for people trying to expand their businesses.
No, you make the perfect point. Hoarding cash is basically the same as putting the brakes on the economy all across the world.
That's exactly, you know, what is happening. Actually, yesterday, you know, I'm based in Singapore. I went to the local office of AIG. You know, they sell insurance all over the world. In fact, AIG was actually founded in Shanghai in Asia, had its roots in Asia. And even with the U.S. government bailout of AIG, there were hundreds of people, old aunties, old uncles, who've been putting their life savings into insurance policies or other investments, even though they had heard that the insurer was bailed out. They had no confidence. They were all going to the AIG office trying to either get their money back or somehow make sure that they won't be losing all their money. So this is the kind of crisis of confidence that we're talking about. So, you know, even if the U.S. government decides or says it will bail out AIG, if people mm-hmm. lose confidence and they take their money out, well, that's in effect same thing as a run on the bank.
Mm, great story.
Psychology of fear. Giuliana Liu, thank you.
Joining
Giuliana
us now.
Liu is a BBC business correspondent, and she was reporting to us from Singapore.
That's a great story. I can see that picture of the sort of run on the bank there at AIG in China. David Weiss joins us now. He's the chief economist for Standard & Poor's, and we're going to try to get a handle on what the source of this volatility is. David, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you.
You know, since you are the chief economist for Standard & Poor's, it occurs to me to ask, you know, what sort of complicity do the ratings agencies have? We've been talking with people all week long about how it's very, very difficult now to use the rating agencies as a guide to what the actual risk of securities is. Hence, there's this crisis of confidence. What's Standard & Poor's position on this?
Well, I can't, you know, obviously speak for what other people think of our ratings. Clearly, there's a lack of confidence in anything resembling risk, and we've gone from a period where the markets were irrationally complacent about risk to a period where they're irrationally afraid of it. And eventually it'll settle down, but when, I'm not sure.
Well, but some people specifically charge that the irrational sort of upside came from the perhaps irresponsible or inappropriate ratings of these mortgage-backed securities, and that that ripple around the world is what we're seeing unwind right now.
Well, to begin with, speculative-grade bonds in the United States were trading at only 260 basis points over Treasuries a year and a half ago. That doesn't make sense given the ratings we had on those bonds. They should have been trading at 500 basis points, at twice what they were.
So what you're saying is there's been a decoupling of the actual rating from the way things are traded.
Well, yes. I mean, let's face it, these things are trading way off their ratings now. They were trading way off their ratings the opposite direction a year and a half ago. You know, if you take that, you'd say they weren't believing us then, and they're not believing us in the opposite direction now.
Well, I don't want to ruin your breakfast this morning by, you know, sort of poking you on this subject, but let's talk about, you know, looking forward. How are the rating agencies, and, you know, Standard & Poor's has, you know, a terrific reputation, and Moody's also. How do the rating agencies become the mechanism for the restoring of some of this confidence and bring a little more precision to the sense of risk out there in the market?
Well, to begin with, we feel the ratings that we've done on the corporations themselves have generally been reasonably solid. We haven't had any, you know, major surprises there. Obviously, we've had some problems in the financial institutions, but that's because their finances have been changing quite quickly. The problems occurred on the structured products, and particularly the more complicated of the structured products.
Do you have a position on the complicated? I mean, how do you warn investors about these complicated structured products? What do you say? Is it a sort of a, is something we don't want to get involved in?
Yeah, for the moment, it's not a problem because nobody's issuing any anyway.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
I think a lot of these are going to disappear. And frankly, I wish they'd never appeared in the first place.
Ah, boy, indeed.
It goes back to the old comments from, you know, investors in the past. Peter Lynch made the comment, if you don't understand it, don't buy it.
That's great advice. Speaking of that, you know, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said at some point early on in the week that we are perhaps less than halfway through what he called the housing correction, which is the extent to which real estate in the United States is losing its value, and that is beginning to cause questions in the portfolios of some of these investment banks around the world. First of all, do you believe that is the case? And if we are, you know, have some more distance to go, what are the implications of that?
Well, to begin with, it depends on which part of the housing crisis you're looking at. If you're looking at it in terms of the physical sales starts, I think there's some encouraging signs that we're getting close to a bottom. I don't think we're quite there yet, but I think we'll get there in the next few months. On the other hand, in terms of prices, I think prices are going to continue to fall through next year in order to get rid of that inventory of unsold homes that's out there. And in terms of the actual losses on the credit, on the securities and on the mortgages themselves, we've already booked a lot of them because people have changed their expectations, but the actual foreclosures, charge-offs, will probably not peak until 2010, maybe even early 2011.
All right, so, and it won't peak till 2010, and we've already lost Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac?
We lost Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac because they are marking to market based on these expectations of losses, not on the losses they've already taken.
I see. So it's possible that under federal control, these institutions will be able to weather this peak that's coming in 2010.
Their cash flow is not doing that badly. What they're losing money on is because they have to mark the securities to market, and those markets are dysfunctional right now.
Sobering thoughts from David Weiss. Thank you, David. David Weiss is a chief economist for Standard & Poor's. We're looking for your stories of the financial crisis on your street, 877-8-MY-TAKE. And coming up, a look at inside information about colleges. How did you learn about the college you attended?
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
How did you learn about the college that you went to? Well, maybe you looked through glossy magazines and literature put out by the university in your guidance counselor's office, or maybe you went on one of those butterfly-in-your-stomach-filled college trips with your parents, driving for hours, going to look at the college, taking a look at the classes, and trying to conclude what school to go to. Well, that's actually an archaic, almost obsolete process for determining where to go to college. And Jonathan Dee, a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, is here to tell us about an alternative. And yes, it's a website, Unigo, a new social networking site that's working hard to ensure that your high school senior doesn't get duped into attending school for the cafeteria food alone or the fact that it's a party school. Jonathan Dee, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You know, the way we all found out about colleges is either, you know, our parents went to one and it had a reputation. There's anecdotal information you can maybe get by hanging around the student union for 5 or 10 minutes. But really, the universities have always controlled their image and their identity through the high schools and the guidance counselors. What's changing with Unigo?
Well, Unigo is It's a massive all online, all student written and student generated effort to basically replace those gigantic doorstopper college guides that have been the staple of the teenage experience for, I don't know, 20 or 30 years. The difference really is that they have found a way to get to the students directly without having to go through the universities, as all the guidebook publishers have always had to do or found it easiest to do. And they've put together a website that when it launched, it just launched last week, mm-hmm. and it's already has 50 times the content of any book or website that already exists, and all of it written or photographed or videotaped by current students at these colleges.
And it's not really like Wikipedia, where people contribute to text exclusively about the subjects. It's really a lot of sharing of stories and information that then gets aggregated into a consensus about an institution.
Exactly. There is one brief overview of each school that's written by a Unigo editor, but apart from that, within certain limits, anything that's submitted just gets thrown on the website. And there are already, as I say, you know, hundreds of contributions, even at startup, from more than 250 universities around North America.
So it starts with a blurb and becomes kind of a scrapbook. What kind of information do you get on Unigo that you could never get from any other kind of source?
Well, you get a very unfiltered student perspective that's both good and bad, because it really starts to sound very much like what you see elsewhere all over the internet, which is a product review. Mm-hmm. Colleges are reviewed on the basis of what they promised and what they delivered, what services they offered. There's you know, no more perspective on it as a kind of educational experience than you might expect from a 19 or 20-year-old. But it is bracingly honest in a mm-hmm. way that something that you get directly from an admissions office is never going to be.
How would it compete with, say, USA Today's famous college rankings of various kinds of schools that get enormous amounts of attention from parents, but maybe less so from students?
Well, they will have rankings, but I think that the sheer numbers on Unigo mitigate against the idea of ranking the schools numerically.
It's more about matching students to the right school.
It is. And because the database is so large, you can search for schools based on certain attributes. You can search to see how many other people from your hometown are looking at a given school.
Oh, that's interesting.
You can, if you want to see a school and see reviews only by African-American English majors, you can do that. And the bigger it gets, the more detailed that kind of searching will become.
And of course, the colleges are totally thrilled with this, right?
The colleges, interestingly, don't really know about it. They know about it as of about 2 weeks ago, because Unigo just decided to give them a little heads up. But the whole thing was put together without the colleges, not only without their participation, but without their knowledge. I know this because I called, for instance, the admissions director at Davidson College in North Carolina. And he'd never heard of it. When a letter came from Unigo announcing themselves, he admitted that he had it on his desk but hadn't found the time to look it up. Now, Davidson already is a small school. Already 250 students from Davidson are on Unigo and reviewing their school.
Wow. How do you – I mean, this, of course, is the honeymoon period right in the beginning. I mean, how do you deal with people who actually have an interest in taking down the school in some way by posting deliberately false information, and then the school itself attempting to spin its image the way that it wants by participating on the site?
They will listen to anything that the school has to say in that regard, and they also have on-campus unpaid interns, liaisons, basically as a kind of reality check if something is submitted that they think is really wrong. But if you're asking what kind of limits they're putting on the content they receive, the answer is very, very few. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and often that does reflect badly on the school, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not. Mm.
Did you find yourself sort of envious, you know, sort of like born at the wrong time as you were looking at Unigo and imagining your own choices, you know, days of choosing a college?
Oh, it would have been a great thing. There's no question. I mean, one of the things that it makes possible is that there's a great video piece to the site. And it's expensive. It's expensive to travel around and look at schools other than the ones that are nearest your home. And if you can just sit at your desk now, you can get a really detailed look at schools all over the country. It would have made a huge difference in my own experience.
And where did you go to college?
I went to Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I went there because my brother had gone there and I really didn't know much better.
So after looking at Unigo, what would have been the alternative? What would have been the plan B or C? Or
I at least would have had one.
Well, you've done very well for yourself, Jonathan.
We're
very proud of you. Jonathan D., writer for the New York Times Magazine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can check out Jonathan D.'s piece on Unigo. That's UNIGO.com in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. And there's also a link to Unigo.com on the takeaway.org on our homepage. And now headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. The world's leading central banks have announced moves designed to stabilize a global economy in turmoil today. The U.S. Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of Japan are banding together with financial institutions the world over to inject at least $180 billion into the markets. Shares of both Morgan Stanley and Wachovia Bank are up before the bell today. The two companies are talking about a merger. Morgan Stanley's value plummeted yesterday on fears that the investment giant may not be able to keep itself going, that it was heading in the direction of the newly bankrupted Lehman Brothers. Dick Cheney is filling in for President Bush at some fundraisers today. The president cancelled a trip to Florida and Alabama so he can meet up with his financial advisers in Washington. He's trying to come up with solutions for the snowballing crisis, rocking U.S. and world markets. And Ike has gone, but people all over the U.S. are still suffering the after effects. Almost 2 million people in Texas still don't have power. Galveston's been declared unfit for habitation. Thousands have been turned back from the island. And in the Midwest, the lights are off in more than 900,000 homes. And the death toll from the storm is now up to 51.
That's alarming.
It is.
2 million still without power.
It's extraordinary.
It takes time. Yeah. So, I mean, 3 weeks after Hurricane Gustav, remember that kind of brushed past New Orleans? Some people still didn't have electricity and power.
Wow.
And that was 3 weeks. And that was when it was warmer time of year as well.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online, or if that's an invasion of their child's privacy. Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Thursday, September 18th, and This week, an unprecedented worldwide study of multiple sclerosis has been released at the International MS Conference in Montreal. MS, a chronic central nervous system disease, was once considered by many a disease that only affects people or mainly affects people in Europe and North America. But researchers involved in this project, which is called the Atlas of MS, says it's actually a global disease. Dr. Alan Thompson is at the conference in Montreal. He joins us now. He is the director of the Institute of Neurology in London, and he also helped to coordinate this global research project. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
So what did the study find out about the global prevalence of MS?
Well, I think the very point you've just made, in fact, we've looked at 112 countries across the world in every continent, and there is evidence of MS everywhere. This is truly a global disease, which, although it's more common in the Northern Hemisphere, is actually prevalent everywhere in the world.
Does it help at all point you in the direction of research to figure out the cause of MS?
Well, I think the cause has always been a great challenge, and I think this what the Atlas tells us is that it's far from straightforward, which I think we know, but that really we have to think about how we manage this condition worldwide and how we actually think about our research strategy so that we don't just focus on the countries with a high prevalence.
And how do you think that study, your study, will be helpful in creating policy?
Well, I think one of the key points that came out of the study was that no matter what country we looked at, the services and the way in which MS was managed could be improved upon. So there are messages here for every country, for North America, Europe, Africa, Australia. And the message really is that we have to look much harder at how we provide our services for people with MS, that we have to have a much more coordinated, joined-up service. Big issues like educating our health professionals so that they understand what multiple sclerosis is, that it affects young people in the primes of their lives, that it creates very complicated disabilities that we need to be able to manage. So there's quite a lot of key issues that comes out of this study.
Doctor, is there any uniformity in the way people with disabilities who have MS are approached in different places in the world?
Well, I mean, there is a huge variability in how they're approached, and I think you can look at countries like the United States and Canada, where services are very organized, but other countries which are developing are still struggling to set up their services, to even set up MS societies that would provide support and information for people with MS.
You know, I guess in looking at your study and having been familiar with MS and people with disabilities here in the United States, I mean,
yes,
this really does deepen the mystery of what causes MS. I mean, in a pretty profound way, it seems to me.
Yes, I think it does. Of course, we're also faced with the problem that now people travel a huge amount, so that we have migrating populations around the world. So it does make trying to identify rather simple causes, like something in the environment or something in our genetic makeup. It makes that it much more complicated. I agree.
Well, I guess the question really is MS likely to become an agenda item for the United Nations or in a sort of public health way, given this prevalence?
Well, I think the WHO is extremely interested in the condition and played a large part in this study with the MS International Federation. So there is a huge awareness. I think the biggest thing is the social and economic impact, because this is a condition which affects people in their 20s and 30s. It and then carries on for decades. It has a huge economic impact. So that if we can try and improve its management, and indeed this is now a treatable condition, and reduce disability, then we can greatly lessen that economic impact. So yes, I think it will reach that sort of world stage.
And to that end, Dr. Thompson, where is some of the more promising research taking place?
Well, I think one of the really great things that's happening is that there is also a very global approach to research, and the key areas, for example, countries like United States, Canada, UK, Australia, that are working together to try and focus their research strategy. And some of the big areas would obviously be trying to stop MS We want to work towards creating a world that's free of MS. So we really want to try and identify the cause and try and prevent it. Another big area is looking at trying to repair the central nervous system. This is not just relevant to MS, but but actually looking at people recovering from their disabilities, which would be a great step forward, but a very challenging one.
Thank you, Dr. Alan Thompson. Dr. Thompson is the director of the Institute of Neurology in London, and he was also one of the doctors who oversaw and coordinated the Atlas of MS.
Well, he makes a great point. If you can tackle the public health issues in MS, you also bring along a lot of other disabilities and a lot of other people who are in medical need, that's for sure.
And money, hopefully, too.
That's for sure. All this morning we've been hearing from many of you on the bailouts. How are the problems on Wall Street creating changes on your own street? This is from Gus. Are these the companies we were supposed to invest our Social Security in when the Bush administration wanted to privatize it? After this debacle of the largest financial institutions, is there any confidence of working citizens to take their Social Security under their own control? Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Headlines now from Femi Oke. Okay.
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. The world's major central banks have bandied together to inject as much as $180 billion into money markets in a bid to stave off the growing financial crisis. The European Central Bank says it's joining the Fed and four other central banks to pump more short-term dollar liquidity into the financial system. And the effects of the cash infusion are already being felt. European markets were up and Wall Street appears headed for a higher open. The presidential candidates are once again hitting the swing states today. Barack Obama will be in New Mexico, while Joe Biden continues his bus tour of Ohio. And Biden hammered John McCain on the economy at various stops around Ohio yesterday. McCain and Sarah Palin plan to visit Iowa and Wisconsin. A leading aid organization, CARE International, says that billions of dollars spent on famine relief are being wasted and too much money is going to emergency aid. The agency says the system of giving aid needs to be overhauled with more funding to protect people from the underlying causes of poverty. And finally, sharing a bed with someone could temporarily reduce your brain power, but only if you're a man. That's the assertion of a new scientist study that's out this week. Men who spend the night with a partner get a poorer night's sleep than women who sleep with a partner. So this is how they did this study. They took 10 couples and they made them sleep 10 nights together. And did some research, and then 10 nights apart. The cognitive test they took when the men slept apart scored much higher than when they slept with their partner.
So if I'm going to a hotel, I actually get smarter if I'm by myself?
You'll be smarter tomorrow, John.
I see. Well, I'm going out to L.A., so yeah, I guess I will be smarter.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you. That's good to know.
And I'm going to have to ponder that one
And all
a
I'm
moment.
Going to say is that I'm smart every day. But I'm hoping to rectify that.
1-800-FEMI-OK. Call 1-800-FEMI-OK.
I could be less smart.
Oh, my.
Thank you, Femi.
Oh, my.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. None of the news this week on Wall Street has been good. Right now, we're going to take a look at just one part of it, and that is the Federal Reserve loaning the global insurance giant, AIG, $85 billion to avoid a fire sale of the company's assets. But what does this mean for policyholders, or for consumers, for that matter? Nancy Trejos is joining us now with some thoughts. She's a personal finance writer with The Washington Post. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning.
So should I worry only if I have a policy with AIG or if I'm just an average consumer? How worried should I be?
Well, first of all, you have to remember that AIG continues to operate. It hasn't filed for bankruptcy protection. It has not been declared insolvent. But if parts of the company are eventually declared insolvent, there are protections in place that are very similar to the FDIC insurance that you get for your bank deposits. Life and health insurance are covered by each state's guarantee association. So each state has an association that will cover your money. The amount of coverage varies from state to state, but typically you should be able to recover cover up to $300,000 in your life insurance death benefits and up to $100,000 in the value of other investments such as annuities. So you really need to check with your state's guarantee association or with this organization that oversees those associations, which mm-hmm. is called the National Organization of Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Associations.
And what about property and, say, mortgage insurance?
Well, if you have other types of insurance, those two are covered. And again, it really depends on the state that you live in. But every state, including and D.C. and Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, has established some sort of fund that will protect against any losses of any types of insurance that you have. And again, it varies by state, but typically you're covered up to about $300,000.
And is there any concern about the various elements of AIG that any of them are going to stop doing business? And is there greater concern if you're an individual versus if you're a, say, small business owner?
Mm-hmm. Well, the infusion of the $85 billion into the company really sort of, I mean, it gives it a lifeline for a couple of years there. We all have to sort of be in wait-and-see mode here to see how the situation unfolds. But analysts believe that for now that insurance policies are safe, again, because of all these protections that are in place for them. And insurance regulators in New York, which oversees AIG, and the National Association of Insurance Commissioners said the company's insurance operations remain solvent and will be able to pay claims.
Okay, so perhaps there is a little bit of comfort in that for some folks who are listening. Nancy Trejos, thank you.
Thank you.
Nancy Trejos is a personal finance writer for The Washington Post.
And we're looking for personal stories about your reaction to the financial crisis at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Also coming up, your electronic footprint. What electronic landfill items do you have still scurrying around your basement? Walkmans, discmans,
that Walkmans old computers,
came
to mind. Yeah.
Commodore
64. How many of those 64s, do you have in your drawers at home?
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
It's Thursday, September 18th, and Femi Okeh has some headlines for us. Femi?
Thank you very much. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is meeting with NATO officials in London today. He's expected to talk with other defense secretaries about what he sees as the hard work of ending insurgent violence in Afghanistan. Also on the agenda, the diplomatic fallout from the conflict between Russia and the Republic of Georgia. In Pakistan, intelligence officials say that a U.S. missile attack on a militant camp along the Afghan border killed 5 people and wounded 3. The attack came as Admiral Mike Mullen met with Pakistan officials in Islamabad to reinforce U.S. respect for Pakistan's sovereignty. A series of recent attacks have strained relations between the two countries. The Israeli Foreign Minister Zivni Livni has narrowly won the election of the governing Kadima Party. She beat Shaul Mofaz by little more than 400 votes. She will replace the outgoing Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who's stepping down to fight allegations of corruption. A fundraising trip in the South has been cancelled by President Bush so he can meet up with his top economic advisers. After another tumble on Wall Street yesterday, President Bush will let Vice President Cheney fill in for him at one of the fundraisers instead. The economy is also issue number one on the campaign trail. John McCain told workers at a GM plant in Michigan he plans to fight special interests and greed, while Barack Obama asked how McCain could take on the old boys network when he hasn't taken them on for the last 26 years. And finally, we go back to the 1950s for a little bit of Betty Davis.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
A new 42nd cent stamp is out today featuring Bette Davis in the 1950 movie All About Eve.
What a great movie.
It's a good one, isn't it?
Oh, it's just such a great movie. She was brilliant in that.
You can pick it up at your local post office for, guess what, 42 cents. Does anybody buy stamps here anymore?
Oh, sure.
Of course.
You still buy stamps?
Yes, absolutely.
Good. Excellent.
Stamp collectors. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Well, it's not a big headline, perhaps, but it is an enormous story. Defense ministers from the 26 and counting members of the NATO alliance are gathering in London today, the first chance NATO has had to rethink its expansion plans in light of the conflict between Georgia and Russia. Also on the agenda are new tensions in Afghanistan over the deaths of civilians in that war against the Taliban and the controversial cross-border raids into Pakistan. Covering the NATO meeting and the trip by Robert Gates, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, to London is BBC diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams. Paul, there's a lot on the table here. Explain how ministers are going to prioritize all this.
There is a great deal on the table. I think it's going to break into two halves. Basically, you'll have tonight at an informal dinner a pretty detailed bit of soul-searching on how NATO should respond to the events of the summer. In other words, the war in Georgia and all the implications for NATO expansion and the plans on the table to invite both Georgia and Ukraine into the alliance. How on earth does NATO do that without further provoking the Russians, who are clearly anxious to assert their own sphere of influence, something which many NATO members are deeply apprehensive about? So that, I think, will dominate the discussions tonight. And
Indeed, Paul, just to hold on it for a second, I mean, it seems as though Medvedev and Putin have drawn a line in the sand on this. So it's not simply a matter of provocation.
Absolutely. I mean, they have made their intentions very clear. And those skeptics within NATO about the membership of Ukraine and Georgia will still say, look, in the case of Ukraine, you've got a country where the majority of the people don't actually want to join NATO. And that is one of the issues that's clearly at the heart of the political disputes at in government in Ukraine. And in the case of Georgia, a country with unresolved territorial disputes that were rather cruelly exposed over the summer, and a leadership in the shape of Mikhail Saakashvili, the president, perhaps with a bit of an inclination to do things, off the cuff and without letting people know. And do you really want a government like that inside the alliance? What would have happened if that war had taken place after Georgia joined NATO?
Exactly.
And Article 5 of the charter would have been invoked, the collective defense article. Would NATO really have wanted to go to war over such a foolhardy operation? So these are very difficult questions.
Those are two very great details. But the other big story out of London today is the discussions on the whole command structure of the Afghan war. Explain what's going on there.
Well, I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding in some of the reporting, which suggests that the American desire is to bring the whole thing under one American-led command. Essentially, at the moment, you have NATO conducting operations in various parts of the country, and then a separate American-led Operation Enduring Freedom, which is principally about counterterrorism, about taking on the remnants of Al-Qaeda, all the cross-border stuff in Pakistan that we've been hearing such a great deal about recently. My understanding from NATO sources is that there is a plan afoot to bring those bits of the American-led operation that would more naturally fall to NATO, and in particular, that's things like embedded training units within the NATO command, leaving the separate OEF to get on exclusively with counterterrorism. And that does make a degree of sense.
Well, explain the relationship between the NATO ministers and Defense Secretary Gates, who's in London today. I gather he's speaking to the BBC, and that's going to air later on this afternoon. But is he sort of reporting to the ministers about U.S. intentions, or is he being called to answer for things like civilian deaths and the cross-border raids into Pakistan?
Well, I'm told that there will be no discussion, at least there is no planned discussion of operational details, and that would include Afghanistan. That is not the purpose of this meeting, and I don't think that the defense ministers are going to be lining up to jab Robert Gates in the chest and say, look, we've got to do something about civilian casualties. Everyone knows that that's a problem and it needs to be dealt with. What they are concerned about, and this is a perennial NATO problem, and this is what Des Brown, the British Defence Secretary, wants them to talk about tomorrow in a very, again, a very informal way, is how on earth does NATO get better at the business of stumping up the required hardware to conduct operations, whether they're Afghanistan or anywhere else. All the problems that we've heard about down the years, about helicopters, about heavy lift aircraft, mm-hmm. the things which make it so hard for NATO to live up to its ambitions. And as NATO prepares for a big summit next year, marking its 60th anniversary, there is a feeling that NATO really has to grasp this one.
And Paul, what's your sense of the willingness of the members of NATO to up their commitment and resources in other ways to the war in Afghanistan?
Well, in some ways, the trend is in the opposite direction. We're going to see in the next couple of years, 2 or 3 years, almost certainly Canada and the Netherlands ducking out of the operation in Afghanistan. There is an acute consciousness that this is a very, very long-term operation. And the number of players willing to do the really difficult and dangerous stuff is actually dwindling. And that probably means that in the long run, there will be more American troops and perhaps more British troops, particularly as if things continue to go well in Iraq and the pressure is reduced in Iraq. But it will fall to Britain, the United States, perhaps France, to do more. That remains a big problem.
And it's politically sensitive, and it brings us around to your original issue. There's some financial realities here. The investments required to support the hardware to make it possible to do all these things suggests that an expansion of NATO is even a financial overreach at this point, and that's really on the table in London.
Yep, there are all sorts of implications. I mean, I think the principal preoccupation with the expansion is how do you do it without angering the Russians any more than they are
That's the first thing.
But also a feeling, and this is very much voiced by Condoleezza Rice, by Robert Gates, it's, you know, we are not going to be bullied into saying, no, Ukraine and Georgia, you've got to wait until the Russians calm down. Quite the reverse. I think they are going to push very, very strongly for NATO to go to press ahead and to move towards the what's called the membership action plan for those two countries, conscious that you know that is going to continue the division and the suspicion that currently exists between NATO and the Russians. I don't see any way in which this really sour relationship is going to get better anytime soon.
And it's worth noting that a year ago, even 2 years ago, the idea of this tense of a discussion on this issue would not have been envisioned at NATO. Paul Adams, BBC diplomatic correspondent, thank you very much. And we should note that Robert Gates said this morning that the Bush administration is considering possible strategic changes in the war in Afghanistan in light of the developments there. Lots of ways to catch up with us at The Takeaway. You can find us on Twitter, Friend Feed, and Facebook.
And we're talking about college. What do you wish you knew before you went?
John, Dartmouth. My father died my senior year in high school. I was so ill-prepared to decide where I wanted to go to school after that, let alone before that happened. I think I'm no different than the hundreds of thousands of kids that try to get into college every year. I think we're not prepared. We don't know what we're looking for because we don't even know who we are.
There's an interesting take. What's your thought? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
If you want guidance about picking a college, you can go to our website where there's a link to unigo.com, U-N-I-G-O.com. Here's your takeaway for today.
If you don't understand it, don't buy it.
Economist David Weiss about what not to do about the market, speaking about complex derivatives and that sort of thing.
Oh, and there'll be certainly lots more talk about that as Wall Street goes through its anxiety, and it's contagious, right? As we've talked about, the world markets are going through their own anxieties.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
George Bailey, where's my money? I want my money.
You're thinking of this place all wrong, as if I had the money back in a safe. The money's not here. Well, your money's in Joe's house. That's right next to yours. And in the Kennedy house and Mrs. Maitland's house and 100 others.
Actually, it's hundreds of thousands of questionable U.S. mortgages all over the world that are making life less than pleasant for bankers. George Bailey meets Morgan Stanley, My So-Called Wonderful Life. Roll the credits. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
It's a very interesting play on words. What do you say? Roll the credits.
Roll the credits.
No pun intended. There,
oh, pun intended. Always on the takeaway.
Good morning. It's Thursday, September 18th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, global markets are really a stew of anxiety. Also, a new New York Times CBS news poll shows the presidential candidates are in a dead heat, but there are some interesting developments in the details. And what really happens the moment you die and you see that bright light? Scientists are trying to find out. We'll tell you about that new study. And have you ever thought about the electronic footprint of your cell phone and every other electronic gadget you own? Greenpeace has, and we have their latest studies. Those stories are coming up, but first, a few headlines.
It could be the mother of all cash bailouts. The Federal Reserve is going in with central banks from Europe to Asia to inject more than $180 billion into the foundering financial markets. European shares are up slightly on the news of the extra cash. U.S. markets are also up ahead of the bell. The AIG bailout didn't do much to help Wall Street yesterday. Those markets plummeted. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost another 4%. The Fed rescue didn't help the mood in Congress either. Lawmakers from both sides of the aisle are blasting the Federal Reserve for handing out $85 billion in taxpayer money without asking them first.
In Iraq today, a U.S. military helicopter went down, killing all seven soldiers on board. The Chinook transport helicopter crashed as it was landing at a base near Basra. Enemy fire is not suspected. In Galveston, Texas, city officials are now taking back an offer to let residents pay a visit to their damaged homes. Yesterday, a 20-mile traffic jam choked the one road into the city as thousands tried to reach home. Here's city manager Steve LeBlanc.
We just had an overwhelming influx of people, and we decided we just simply cannot handle the volumes of people that are coming in.
Almost 2 million people in Texas still do not have power.
History in Israel. Move over, Golda Meir. Tzipi Livni, Israel's foreign minister, could be the country's next prime minister. She just barely won the ruling party's vote to replace outgoing leader Ehud Olmert. If the coalition holds, she would be the first female prime minister since Golda Meir. Drivers in Minnesota honked their horns and waved American flags as they crossed the newly opened I-35W bridge this morning. The old bridge collapsed a little more than a year ago, killing 13 people. The rebuild is a very emotional event there in the Twin Cities. Unemployment up by more than 10,000. Fallout from Hurricane Gustav. We begin with the markets again. A rocky financial week on Wall Street. What about your street? Tell us how your finances have been affected. We've been hearing stories from you all week long. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Let me offer an advance warning to the big spending, greedy, do nothing, me first, country second crowd in Washington, D.C. and on Wall Street. Change is coming, and it's coming on January the 20th.
We can't steer ourselves out of the crisis if the new driver is getting directions from the old driver. And that's what this election's all about.
Boy, what is this election all about with the change of focus from week to week? It's difficult. Is it the economy stupid or it's the stupid economy? Both candidates there speaking yesterday, John McCain in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Barack Obama speaking in Las Vegas, both talking about the economy and both trying to get a handle on where this campaign is going, along with the pollsters who have their own challenges. And there's a new CBS News New York Times poll, and it gives a interesting profile of an election that seems very, very too close to call, very, very even, Steven. Adam Nagorny joins us to talk about the new CBS News New York Times poll. He is a writer for the New York Times. Thanks for joining us, Adam.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
It must be difficult to try to create a portrait of the trends in the campaign right now, but what does this poll show as far as you can tell?
I think one of the advantages of this poll is that we waited a couple of weeks after both conventions and the choice of vice presidential candidates to go out there and poll people. One of the difficulties, I think, is that people went out there and started polling with all this sort of flux going on, and people reacted very quickly to what was going on at the conventions and the vice presidential candidates. So I think this gives you a fairly good snapshot right now of where we are. And what it suggests, frankly, is that things have not changed dramatically from where we were before the conventions, that overall the two conventions and the selections of the vice presidential candidates by Senator McCain and Senator Obama didn't dramatically change the landscape in any sort of lasting way, at least for now. It did suggest, the poll basically shows that it tied. It did suggest that Senator McCain has so far had difficulty accomplishing what has been appeared to be his main task even before this latest economic meltdown, which was to try to seize the mantle of change away from Senator Obama. By a vast majority, people say that Senator Obama is more likely to bring change to Washington than Senator McCain.
The fact that the numbers are relatively even, does that suggest that both bases, Republican and Democratic, are now energized and, you know, it's playing out the way elections have in the past? Or does it mean that neither candidate is offering a real clearly delineated proposal in light of the economic meltdown that we're seeing?
I mean, the first thing is this is and remains a very divided country. As unpopular as I think Republicans are right now and President Bush is, this is a very divided country. One thing that Senator McCain clearly accomplished with his convention and with his selection of Governor Palin as his running mate was to energize his base, was to get Republicans to get in line behind him. And I think that you see on both sides that party partisans are getting behind their candidate, which typically happens in a race at this point. I think what's going on now is you have a group of undecided voters who are not atypically waiting to make a decision until the end. And I think it's for all the reasons we talked about. People have concerns about both candidates, and they're not quite ready to close the deal yet. And that's not surprising. We have three debates to go. You know, we're still 8 weeks out. So that's where we are, I think.
Adam, some of the details of the poll are interesting, particularly those about white women. There was a real difference prior to the conventions between McCain and Obama, McCain doing much better. But this poll shows something different.
Yeah, again, that's one of the areas where we've seen a lot of movement in polls between various polls. And you got to be very careful, say, comparing one operations polls to another operations poll, like a New York Times poll to a Washington Post poll. What we saw was that McCain had a significant but relatively slight edge among women, white women, before the convention, and that now they're basically even. Now, there were a series of polls right after the selection of Senator Palin, which suggested that Senator McCain had received an increase in women's support among white women of various degrees, in some cases large. Now, I think that is possible, and that would be the same effect that we saw with Geraldine Farrow when Walter Mondale selected her in 1984, which is that there was a momentary move of a woman to his ticket, and they sort of moved away. So that might be what's going on here right now.
Well, it sounds like it's more a signal than it is noise right now, and that we are in an even race. Next stop, next event, of course, is the debate next Friday, the first debate next Friday. Adam Nagorny, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Adam Nagorny of the New York Times talking about the new CBS New York Times poll, which shows a pretty even presidential race, Adora.
And John, we're going to continue our discussion on the anxieties of the marketplace, not just here in the United States, but all over the world. The Asian markets, well, they plunged today, and international reaction has not been good to the American banking crisis. We're going to be joined right now by Dr. Pippa Malgren. She is a former financial market advisor to President Bush, and she's coming to us from Beijing. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you've been traveling throughout Asia all of this week, and you were in Taipei on Monday when the collapse really gained some traction. Describe the reaction there.
Well, on Monday, Taipei was the only market in Asia that was open, so the market was quite tough on it because there was no place else to execute. But the fact is, in the region, people are very much realizing that, first of all, the decoupling idea that somehow Asia would be fine even though the U.S. was having a problem no longer works. But the bigger issue is that people are very worried that in addition to the American financial crisis, that we're going to see a slowdown in China. And that's a double whammy for the region.
And that's how the oil markets have been reacting as well. You know, we were talking earlier with the BBC's Singapore correspondent who was saying that in Asia, cash is king. Everybody's sitting on their money right now. Given the volatility of currencies, what does that mean for investments in Asia?
Well, interestingly, all the Asian markets were what they call limit up in the gold market yesterday and today, which means that the demand to buy gold is outstripping the capacity to buy it. So this indicates that people are starting to be very nervous about holding their savings in cash, and they're looking to turn it into some kind of a hard asset like gold. And I think that's reflective of a general sense that people are extremely uncertain about which financial institutions are sound and which ones are not. We have to remember these are not only American financial institutions that are under attack from the markets. You have institutions in Australia, for example, Babcock and Brown as an example, that the markets are also savaging. There are lots of questions about who had exposure to what. And that is a worldwide phenomenon. It's not just American.
And there seems to be this general consensus that things are going to have to change the way that business is done. And do you think that movement towards that will create any confidence that the market, there's a way to dig itself out here in the U.S.?
Oh, I think that the rules of the game are going to be dramatically changed by these events. And in fact, we don't even have to wait for the regulators to do this. The market is doing it itself. It's taking institutions out of the game who don't have a viable business model any longer. So in other words, you know, it's not just that Lehman Brothers failed. It's the market is now testing, does the concept, the business model of investment banking still hold true? And that's why all the investment banks are under siege, as it were. So the market is trying to figure out kind of its own level. Now, it would be helpful if Congress could create a resolution trust. They have indicated that they now understand this needs to be done. The problem is we're in the middle of a campaign, as you've been covering, and all of the members of Congress, one-third of the Senate, are all up for re-election, and they're going off to campaign. And they're like, well, when we get back, we will set up a resolution trust. But that's, you know, weeks, if not months away, which is too long for the market. So in the meantime, they've tried to set up a private sector group of 10 banks that have put up about $70 billion, plus the SEC has effectively prohibited short selling. So these are sort of temporary measures that will hopefully create some kind of a floor, but I have to say I'm not entirely confident that these will work in the absence of creating an actual mechanism for absorbing broken assets.
Now, are you at all surprised that we haven't seen President Bush up front and more visible this week on the economy?
I think that in this kind of environment that it does make sense. Usually you would have your Secretary of the Treasury playing the lead role. I think that the markets are extremely sensitive. And so one wrong word out of the president or any other senior official, the media will jump on that. Notice what has happened. You know, John McCain said, oh, the fundamentals are strong, and that has created a firestorm. So in a sense, I think they're just trying to let the Secretary of the Treasury, whose responsibility this is, you know, bear the weight and manage the process.
Dr. Pippa Malgren, we thank you for your time and we wish you happy travels. Dr. Malgren is a former financial market advisor to President George W. Bush and also the president of the Canonbury Group.
I hope she wasn't saying that they believe if President Bush spoke, he would say something wrong and cause the markets to tank.
It does make you wonder a little bit because you do have the Secretary of the Treasury talking.
Go with Paulson, not Bush. Go with Paulson.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, September 18th, and I got a question for you, John. How much money do you think that Hollywood has made over the decades with movies about the afterlife and out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences?
Well, there was Ghost and...
Ghosts and spirits and...
I see dead people. Oh, there's one now. There's one. Yes.
Well, we're obsessed. There is an obsession that exists, a human obsession with the afterlife and what it means. And essentially all scientists have to go on are stories that people report when they do get close to death and come back. So-called out-of-body experiences. Well, right now, a United Kingdom university is trying to find out what exactly happens with death or in death by carrying out the world's largest scientific study into near-death experiences. And joining me now to explain what all of this means is the leader of the study, Dr. Sam Parnia. Good morning, or I should say good afternoon for you, Dr. Parnia. Explain what this study is about exactly.
Well, this is the largest ever study which aims to determine what happens to the human mind and consciousness during clinical death. And it's an important study because we certainly know biologically what happens to the body when we're going through death. We know that we define death when the heart stops beating, people stop breathing, and the brain also shuts down as a consequence of a lack of blood flow. But then a big question arises is, well, at what point does the human mind and consciousness cease functioning? Is it at the moment the heart stops beating? Is it a few seconds later? Is it a few minutes later? Or is it even hours later? And we certainly don't know. What's really led to this study is the observation that all our data from people who've gone through clinical deaths show that the brain no longer functions because there is no blood flowing into it. Yet paradoxically, 10 to 20% of people who have gone through clinical death and are brought back to life will report some kind of activity of their mind and consciousness. And so the question is, you know, are these real? Do people really have continuation of consciousness when they're going through death? Or is this just an illusion? It's something that they think really happened but didn't really happen to them.
It's those stories that we hear of people saying they felt like they were in a tunnel, that there was a bright light, that they had contact potentially with other people they knew who were deceased. I mean, this has been a very common story that you've heard from many parts of the world in those near-death experiences.
Yes, you've pointed out something very absolutely correct, that these experiences have been reported from all over the world and from all different age groups, even children less than 3 years old. The key, though, is that a lot of what people describe is very personal. It's subjective. They may say they saw a tunnel or a light or deceased relatives, and we have no way scientifically of validating these. We cannot tell whether they're real or not, and that's why there's a lot of debate about them. However, there are some people, a proportion of them, who will describe being able to watch doctors and nurses working on them in specific detail. And they'll tell us, for example, Dr. Smith walked into the room. As he saw me laying there, he ran across the bed, he hit a bucket of instruments, everything fell to the ground. He started frantically pressing on my chest. And I was watching everything from above, and I was perfectly peaceful and comfortable. And that's the component that can be validated and tested scientifically, and that's what we're interested in.
And how do you do that exactly?
Well, the only way to really put an end to this whole debate of whether these are real or illusions is to use an objective marker, and that's how we have to do it scientifically. So what we've done in the first instance, we have, as you may have known, we've recruited 25 major medical centers in the UK and the United States to do this study. And what we've done is we've pre-installed the areas in the hospitals where we think we're more likely to have people have a cardiac arrest. So in other words, say the coronary care unit, the emergency areas, with images that are only
visible.
Come on
over here. Just come on over here to the studio.
I'll come over. Maybe my own studio, yeah. Too. You might give me half one. Yeah. So what we do is we put pictures that are only visible from the ceiling and nowhere else. So they're about 6'7" from the ground. And the idea is very simple. If we get, say, 300 people as part of this study who have these so-called out-of-body experiences, they claim they could watch doctors and nurses working at them from the ceiling. Well, then in theory, they should also be able to see these pictures. Now, if nobody comes back and has seen the picture that was up there, then that simply confirms that this is a false memory, it's an illusion. If on the other hand somehow, and we have no explanation for why this should happen, but if somehow they do come back and they can all see the pictures that are there, then that's very significant, and it means that the mind being the mystery that it is, we've added an extra level of mystery that maybe the mind and consciousness can even separate from the brain and continue to function when the brain is no longer working.
Well, ultimately, do you suspect that this will give you a portrait of the last moments of consciousness, or will it, on the other hand, deliver a portrait of some netherworld between life and death that is part consciousness and part something else?
Well, you see, although 50 or 100 years ago, when somebody died, there was no point even debating what would happen to them because there was no way of bringing them back to life. As science progresses, we are pushing back those boundaries, and we have this land, this sort of intermittent period where the cells in the body are damaged but not sufficiently, such that if you can restart the heart, you can bring people back from death. And it's important to understand what happens at that time. So at the very least, what we've come to understand is that death is a pleasant experience for the majority of people, maybe not, say, for specific cases, let's say, of traumatic suicide, but for the majority of us, when we go through death, it is a pleasant experience. Now, does it mean that it's the brain switching off in a very pleasant, programmed way? Does it mean that consciousness may somehow continue? We don't know, but those are the key questions that need to be addressed.
Well, it's really interesting.
It's fascinating, actually. I think we were both a little speechless there for a second, which is rare for the two of us.
No, we were near death.
we were near death. But where are you in the? Where are you in this? This is an 18-month study, correct? Where are you on that continuum?
Well, as you can imagine, this is a big project, and the reason why it has to be big is that most people who have a cardiac arrest, by definition, they've died, and you know, most people, we cannot bring them back to life. So it's a very difficult, tricky subject to study. So we have to try to recruit about 1,500 patients who survived a cardiac arrest, which means that we'll be starting out with about 15,000 cases of actual events. And of those, we might get about 100 so-called out-of-body experiences.
Well, one thing is certain. You're going to be changing the definition of what it means to die. I mean, it sounds like that's absolutely clear.
I think it's important scientifically to think, because what really matters is what happens to, if I'm dying, what matters is what's happening to me as a person, not what my cells are doing. And the question is, at what point does consciousness cease functioning? That's what we're trying to define. Because just to touch, I know time is very brief, you know, there are drugs that may be developed in the future that might even delay the process of cell death. And it may be that somebody might be hovering in that period for hours or days. And so we need to know what they will experience. I was just going to say, I know that, again, radio is very limited, but if anyone's interested, we announced this study at the United Nations here in New York, and they can go to a website, mindbodysymposium.com, and we have interviews and all the details of the study that explains, for example, we're using sophisticated brain technology to study what happens to brain precisely in each individual, how we will progress with the study if we get positive results, how we will progress if we get negative results.
And uh-huh.
There's a whole plan. But ultimately,
and I certainly hope that you will let us check in with you as you go along on this journey to find out about death. Dr. Sam Parnia, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Sam Parnia is an expert in the field of consciousness during clinical death, and he is leading this study into what happens between when we are unconscious and when we actually die. Interesting, huh?
Yeah, I'm just sitting here wondering, you know, about my own experience. I was in a car accident a long time ago. It's interesting to think about, actually. Quite interesting to think about. But, you know, let's not dwell on death, okay? It's the takeaway.
It's the takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online, or if that's an invasion of their child's privacy. Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Right now we have the latest headlines for you. Femi Okeh is here with the latest news. Femi.
Thanks very much. About 28 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. The Federal Reserve and other major central banks around the world will make as much as $180 billion available to global money markets. There's a hope that will keep a worldwide credit crisis from getting worse. Wall Street is headed for a higher open on the news after other worldwide markets also get a boost. And President Bush is set to deliver remarks on the current world financial crunch, and that will be later on this morning. Authorities said that no Americans were injured in the attack on the U.S. embassy in Yemen, but the State Department has updated that information and just said that a young American woman was killed. The 18-year-old from New York was outside the embassy with her new Yemeni husband. Suspected Al-Qaeda-linked militants unleashed a hail of bullets and exploded two suicide bombs outside the front gates yesterday, and authorities have arrested 30 suspects. Meanwhile, the talk on the campaign trail is firmly focused on the economy. John McCain promised to fix the problems on Wall Street.
I will fight to reform Wall Street and protect the savings and pensions of the American people. I'll make sure that Washington works for your interests and not the special interests.
However, from the campaign trail, Senator Obama questioned McCain's ability to do that after his storied career in Washington.
This is somebody who's been in Congress for 26 years, who put seven of the most powerful Washington lobbyists in charge of his campaign. And now he tells us that he's the one who's going to take on the Old Boys Network. The Old Boys Network. In the McCain campaign, that's called a staff meeting.
Well, if they have to be bickering, it's good that they're funny. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi. Has Wall Street found a bottom? Looks like maybe it has. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 100 this morning in the early going, and that's consistent with what the futures were saying. The S&P is up about 1% and some change there. I don't know if you follow the news of the constant financial turmoil day to day, but if you're like me and you drift off to sleep, I keep having the same dream.
Lehman Brothers.
Fannie Mae, AIG.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
And AIG. Fannie and Freddie. Lehman.
Fannie and Freddie.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
AIG.
Merrill Lynch.
AIG and the Merrill Lynch.
Merrill Lynch.
Lehman Brothers.
Then Lehman Brothers.
Wake up, John. Wake up. Wake up. After an unprecedented series of bailouts and bankruptcies that go with all of those names, we've been wondering if there's a way for a bailout to stop the momentum of this slide. I mean, how do you design a bailout to really do that? So to figure that out, we've got our friend David Leonhardt, who's financial writer for the New York Times. David, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
How are your dreams? Are they...
They're okay.
They're good. That's good.
Yeah, they're okay.
That's good.
If the Red Sox could start winning again, they'd be better.
See, that's
go
a good.
Red Sox.
You need
yeah.
a distraction. So the idea of a bailout and this whole principle of moral hazard and too big to fail, that whole thing, the idea is to try to design a program that's going to stop the momentum of some kind of a financial slide. And I'm wondering if you see, first of all, the chance that that could actually happen. And, you know, is that indeed what these bailouts are designed to do? Stop a bigger slide?
They are designed to do it, but I think there's sort of a subtle difference here that's important to keep in mind. These bailouts are fundamentally defensive, and so I think the odds that any one bailout is going to turn the psychology of Wall Street is pretty slim. I don't think we're going to see a bailout of AIG, for example, work, and then everyone on Wall Street is going to say, oh, this problem is over. Instead, I think the reason the government does this, and a lot of the people in government doing this hate the idea of doing it, right? I mean, a lot of these people are Republicans who really don't think the government should have too active a role in government. And now
a little late for that right now,
well,
isn't
it? Well, it is, and that's why they're doing it. That's why they're doing it, to their credit, because they understand that even if in a perfect world the government wouldn't be owning a large chunk of AIG, the alternative looks far worse at this point. But I think that's the way to think about this. It's not that they hope by doing it they can end the crisis. It's that they fear that by not doing it, the crisis would get a lot worse. And another way of saying that is that the solution isn't likely to come from a bailout. It's likely to come from some combination of time, falling asset values, and more fundamental policy changes.
Well, let's talk about that in a moment. But there is precedent for the federal government owning something. I mean, Amtrak is left over from the bailout of Penn Central, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's not clear to me that there's quite precedent for it owning something like AIG.
Right.
I mean, if you think about Amtrak, transportation in much of the world is owned by the government. It's just not clear that it exactly works in the private sector. Now, it's not clear that Amtrak works either, but that's a different story.
Well, let's look at what the central banks did around the world today. More than $2 billion injected into the financial system. I mean, by my count, and, you know, I'm not an expert on this, the Fed has something on the order of $800 billion at its disposal, and, you know, $180 billion was ponied up by the U.S. banks today. I mean, are we, you know, $800 billion and counting down now?
Well, I mean, there's no question that the Fed has started to use some significant portion of its resources. And you know, on the one hand, you could start to worry it can't do this forever. Now, Ben Bernanke won at one point the joking nickname of Helicopter Ben, because back when we were worried about deflation in the early part of this decade, he reminded people, look, if the government needs to, it can print money. And he's raised the specter of dropping money out of a helicopter, which was not a serious notion. But the point is that the government does have a huge number of resources at its disposal, and it's not clear to me that we're yet at the point in which the Fed is on the verge of running out of bullets. On the other hand, the consequences for it, there are consequences for it using up its resources, and this is likely to worsen the deficit, and this is serious stuff.
But back to your point about can this go on forever, one of our listeners was asking exactly that. They're writing checks for in Iraq and Afghanistan war. They're writing these billion-dollar checks for to help these companies on Wall Street. At what point is there no money in the piggy bank?
Well, I think the short answer to that is taxes are going to have to come up. I mean, if you look at the deficit that we're now running, it is nowhere near as large as the deficit as we had in the early 90s and the late 80s. But the way we got rid of that deficit was that George H.W. Bush raised taxes and Bill Clinton raised taxes. And when you combine three things, the current deficit we now have, the fact that these moves, while they're complicated and there's not a direct relationship between them and the deficit, these moves are going to increase the deficit, and the massive increase we're going to have in Medicare spending because of the retirement of the baby boomers and the increase in health care costs, there's just no way, it seems to me, that we don't get our deficit down without raising taxes. The other way to do it would be to have enormous cuts in spending, but there is currently no politician who is willing to propose a list of spending cuts that would come anywhere close to doing this, and the reason is a lot of government spending is popular.
Government spending is probably like that popular idea of dropping money from a helicopter. The campaigns would love that. David Leonhard, financial writer for the New York Times, giving us that great idea. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 143 points. The S&P up about 1%, maybe approaching 2%. Meanwhile, oil is bumping up against $100 a barrel again. That's the latest from the markets. Open about 11 minutes now.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. From the woes of investment bankers in a financial crisis to the 220 million people living on what CARE International calls the edge of emergency, people in poverty. Joining us now is Vanessa Rubin, who's a hunger advisor for CARE International. Vanessa, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
What I wanted to talk to you about is this report CARE International is releasing that argues that reactive funding for poverty and disaster relief is actually encouraging the population of people living in this edge of emergency zone, and that something more strategic needs to be done to bring people farther away from that edge. Can you explain the argument?
That's absolutely right. What we're arguing is that there's been a real tendency in the international aid system to kind of firefight, to respond to emergencies when they get to their peak. Now, particularly with food crises, like we're seeing in Ethiopia at the moment, we've got 6 million people who are severely at risk because of a food crisis. The point is there's so much you can do earlier on that is a more cost-effective and efficient use of aid. I mean, in Ethiopia in particular, you've got people who are dependent on livestock for their livelihood. Now, you can work with them to give them access to vets, to animal feed, to markets, so they can sell animals at the right price. It's a much better use of aid funding than waiting until they get to the point where they're destitute and then responding with a food aid distribution, which is more expensive and less dignified.
Although some would argue that micro-capitalism approaches that have done such great work in places like Bangladesh really get washed away, just like the people and villages in the serious flooding that takes place there. And so there are certain aspects of poverty that are immune to a lot of this this strategic work?
What I've seen when I've worked with people in Africa, from Zambia to Niger to Ethiopia, is that they have an amazing resilience to things like drought. And they've been doing this for centuries, and they've been coming up with ways to make themselves more resilient. Now, what the role of agencies like CARE is to come and support that. And in order to do that, we need funding that's there early and flexible enough to enable us to do that. But the problem we find is that the funding becomes available only at the point where it's, for some people, it's too late when they've lost everything.
Now, CARE, of course, has, you know, received its funding from a lot of these kind of reactive moments where people give millions and millions when they see pictures on television. Is this about changing the business model of dealing with poverty, going to a more endowment approach? Or do you simply want people to give not as a reactive kind of impulse?
The word changing the model is exactly what it's about. I mean, we would never argue don't give in an emergency, you know, food aid when people are really on the edge is vital and life-saving, and that's so important. But yes, think about what kind of thing that you want to be, and that counts for individuals, it counts for governments, it counts for UN as well. But recognize that you have so much more power to protect people at a much earlier stage and an ongoing process of support than you do to respond just afterwards. Because once the person's received the food aid, they're going to be back in the same vulnerable position again. And in places like the West Africa and the Horn of Africa, we know there are droughts. We know that food prices are rising. We know that people are going to face these problems again.
So we have all the information we need to get strategic. Vanessa Rubin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Vanessa Rubin is hunger advisor for CARE International. It's worth pointing out in this financial crisis that the 220 million people living on CARE International's edge of emergency is double the figure of 2 years ago.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, September 18th, and Femi Oke has just joined us. And Femi, you got some headlines?
I certainly do. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The world's major central banks have bandied together to inject as much as $180 billion into money markets in a bid to stave off the growing financial crisis. The move seemed to stabilize global markets a little bit. European markets are up and Wall Street opened slightly up, which goes a bit of a way to counter the huge slides this week. President Bush will deliver a public statement in the next hour on the financial crisis. The U.S. markets are likely to react to slightly higher than expected jobless claims. They were up 10,000 from last week, mostly due to jobs lost from Hurricane Gustav. And the State Department now says that one American was killed in yesterday's attack on the U.S. embassy in Yemen. The 18-year-old was standing at the embassy gates at the time of the attack. And finally, Israel has a new prime minister, Tzipi Livni. Livni is a former agent of Israel's National Intelligence Agency, better known as Mossad. She's been a politician for 10 years and is sometimes known as Ms. Clean. No military experience and apparently likes to unwind playing the drums. Now, our partners at the BBC have talked to friends and politicians to dig a little deeper into the personality of the most powerful woman in Israeli politics.
A very good friend, a warm person, a person that is very honest, very reliable. She's a real leader.
She's quite cold in her attitude to people and behaves sometimes in a very bizarre way.
She turned a lot of people off when she said, Olmert, you quit, but I'm not quitting. She looked like a politician with no elbows when she did that.
A very tough and determined lady with a great deal of fire in her belly.
You know, my favorite piece of factoid from her history is that her parents are part of the Jewish underground and they were fighting the British when the Brits were in charge of Palestine. And her parents met robbing a British train. And that's how her parents got together, robbing a train.
Well, that's romantic.
It is romantic,
yeah,
isn't
course.
It? And yeah. Fighting for your nation.
Indeed. C.P. Livni.
Yes.
New Prime Minister of Israel, if the coalition holds. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
And carbon footprints, that bring anything to mind?
Well, we were talking about, you know, electronic landfill, all the old gadgets I have around, their environmental significance. My wife calls me the worst sort of electronic gadget
collector
of all time.
Okay, all right. Give it up. What do you got hanging around?
Oh, tons of stuff. I mean, old Walkmans, iPods, you know, microphones, CD players, everything.
That may not be a good thing, John.
I know it isn't.
Because some people now, these days, are thinking about gadgets and being green and wondering if there is a way to do both at the very same time. And it's something that Casey Harrell thinks about a lot. Casey's what you call a toxicity campaigner for Greenpeace. And yesterday, Greenpeace released the 9th edition of its Guide to Green Electronics, which is essentially a survey of corporate behavior on recycling, dangerous chemical use, and climate change, all of those issues. Casey, let's start with toxicity campaigner. What is that?
Well, we work on a lot of different issues that are, that involve reducing toxic chemicals and people's exposure to them. So when we saw how much different toxic chemicals were put into our electronics, and we have so many electronics, it was an issue that we began to pay attention to.
So tell us about the survey. Who came out looking very green and who didn't?
Well, our survey, we do it quarterly. These electronics companies, they love to be cutting edge put out new products, you know, seemingly every week. Your new cell phone was outdated about 2 days after you bought it. And so,
it feels that way, right?
Right. You have the new, brand new thing coming around the block. So we keep our guide updated every quarter. So every 3 months we put it out. It's based on a set of criteria that needs to be on company websites. We talk to a lot of these major global companies, everything from Nokia to Sony to Apple to Microsoft to Dell, all the big names. But this needs to be stuff that consumers can see on their website, not backdoor, you know, conversations that they have with us. So it measures everything from, you know, what toxic chemicals are you phasing out of your products that have been identified as dangerous, and it also talks about, you know, energy efficiency. How energy efficient are the products that you're using? You know, electronics in general they contribute about 2% of the global greenhouse gas emissions that come through, which is
pretty significant. Can you say that again? How much?
2%, which, you know, is not insignificant. It's roughly the same as comes to us from all of our flying. All the airline industry contributes about 2% as well. So it's not insignificant. This is mainly coming to when our gadgets are being used, not when they're being made. It's when they're being used and pulling a bunch of energy. So how energy efficient are these gadgets? You know, how everything from televisions to
cell phones, iPods, DVD players.
Exactly. And then finally, you know, when you can no longer use your gadget, where, you know, when it needs to go to the electronic graveyard in the sky, what happens to that gadget? You know, increasingly companies are coming out with really great policies that say, you know, hey, what, you know, just like our mothers told us, when you make a mess, you got to clean it up. And so they're taking financial responsibility for these goods. You know, you and I can log on to a lot of different websites here in the States. And if we've purchased it, like if we have an Apple laptop that no longer can be used, mm-hmm. Apple will pay for us to send it back to them so they can actually deal with it properly. We don't want these things burned in waste incinerators. They release their toxic chemicals. We don't want them dumped in.
Overall, though, Nokia scored pretty well, 7 out
That's
of 10
right.
points. And what is that company doing right?
Well, they're a company that only makes a small set of products. They don't make the whole gamut like a Sony or like a, you know, Panasonic or something like that. Nokia makes cell phones. They do it pretty well. They phased out a lot of toxic chemicals. They phased out things like PVC, plastic that when burned releases cancer-causing chemicals. They're pretty energy efficient, and they're doing by far the best job globally in terms of take-back programs, you know, establishing programs that don't charge consumers extra money to responsibly get rid of their goods once they're no longer being used.
Well, congratulations to Nokia, but there's also an argument that all cell phones, are actually very environmentally damaging in sort of more tightly targeted ways. For instance, the element columbide tantalite, the coltan, which is used in all cell phones, is fueling civil war in Congo. It's tremendously toxic. toxic. Its mining produces all kinds of public health hazards. I mean, all these cell phones are bad.
That's true. And in a way, the white elephant with all of this is the amount of electronics that are being used. You know, I mean, I think that we can get a green electronic that, you know, and just for the record, coltan, which you're referring to in the Congo, the amount of coltan that's used that comes from the Congo is still relatively small, but as the resource gets more and more rare because we make more and more phones, it's going to put more and more pressure to go to places where there is conflict. It's kind of making the conflict diamond thing becoming a conflict electronic. But you know, the white elephant in the room here is that we can have a green electronic that's made without toxic chemicals, that runs energy efficiently, and you know, these companies will come to your door and pick it up for you. You know, and the bottom line is that, you know, these things are designed for the dump. That we call it planned obsolescence, where, you know, just like I was saying, your brand new cell phone, your brand new laptop is outdated 2 weeks after you buy it. You know, where if we don't see a change in extending the life of these goods,
mm-hmm.
you know, just like when, you know, my parents' generation, nothing ever broke. If it broke, you repaired it. You didn't buy a new one. You definitely didn't throw it away. And so, until we can begin to extend the life of these, and actually we're seeing the opposite thing. You know, 10 years ago, a cell phone lasted us 4, 5, 6 years if you had one. Now you might have two, and you get a new one every 12 to 18 months. Same thing with laptops, desktop computers, et cetera.
And that's what's got to change.
Yeah, we've got to extend the life of these. And that's a much harder thing because these companies are more than willing to green their product line. But when you start talking to them about extending their product life, that's
a whole other question, because then
absolutely.
You start denting into sales. But you're certainly bringing some awareness. Casey Harrell, thanks so much for joining us.
You betcha.
Casey Harrell is a toxicity campaigner at Greenpeace, and he coordinates the Greenpeace Green Electronics and Products Guides. You think I'd like saying that, toxicity campaigner?
You did pretty well with that. Yeah. Catch up with us at The Takeaway on Twitter, Friend Feed, and Facebook.
And it's certainly been a rocky financial week on Wall Street, as we've been talking about on the show. But what about on your street? How are you reacting to the latest economic news? Ellen in Maplewood, New Jersey, says this. Has anyone put together the correlation between government subsidies and corporate buyouts and CEO compensation? It would be interesting to know what companies who accept our money pay their bosses every year, as well as on the way out.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're watching the markets. Oil is trading right around $100 a barrel. And here's your takeaway for today.
At the very least, what we've come to understand is that death is a pleasant experience for the majority of people.
I did not know that. Dr. Sam Parnia, an expert in the field of consciousness during clinical death, he's leading an unprecedented, interesting study on the near-death experience. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.